Key headlines: US President Donald Trump's campaign makes a long shot bid at the Supreme Court to challenge President-elect Joe Biden's victory in Pennsylvania. Many countries around the world banned flights to and from Britain as London said the spread of a more infectious new coronavirus strain was out of control. Also ahead, dozens of domestic flights due to leave Sydney are cancelled and more health alerts issued as Australia is battling to contain a fresh COVID-19 outbreak in its largest city. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour: US President Donald Trump's campaign has filed a long shot bid at the Supreme Court to challenge President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the state of Pennsylvania. The bid was made in a petition that asked the justices to reverse the outcome of the presidential race. The case is filed nearly 7 weeks after Election Day and just a month before Biden is set to be inaugurated. It comes as Trump continues to say he has been cheated and judges around the country have resoundingly rejected his and his allies' allegations of fraud. The challenge follows a similar suit brought by the state of Texas, which the justices refused to hear earlier this month. Frank Emspach is an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin. Ronnie Carvello is our correspondent in Miami. To get some more reaction on this, let me go to Miami first. Ronnie, you got Trump filing yet another lawsuit. How much tension will this add to what is already a volatile political landscape?
Well, he's reaching 60. Well, he's with that one, it'll be 58 cases that he's trying to win, and so far he lost all of them. One important thing that I need to mention about that is that the Supreme Court is already out. It won't be back until January 8th, 2 days after the Congress is set to meet and count officially the votes and proclaim the winner of the election. So. And even if he wins this, this another try at the Supreme Court, won't change a bit the result, the outcome of the election. So I strongly believe that everything is regarding money. He's already reaching almost $300 million from his supporters. They're donating money. So. I think that, of course, the whole idea is to keep receiving money, those donations, and as much as he can push and keep going with that, more money will be coming to his pocket.
So on that note, regarding the system, Trump, as you say, repeating his argument that the vote was rigged. Many believe the election system is a corrupt one. Hillary Clinton the other day called for the Electoral College to be abolished. It doesn't sound very democratic, Frank.
Well, you made a comment, an editorial comment there, that the system is corrupt. I don't think so in that sense. There was no evidence of corruption in the sense of vote stealing or maneuvering. I think the system was set up basically in an undemocratic fashion in 1787, where you had an Electoral College. And specifically, the founders said that they wanted an electoral college as a way of checking the passions, as they put it, of the electorate. And we still have that. There was also an argument that the electoral college favored slavery, which is true. It gave overrepresentation to the slave states, and there was a reason for that. Anyway, here we are 250 years later, and yes, the electoral college stands in the way of the popular vote. And Hillary Clinton and many, many other people have said that, but it will take a constitutional change to do that. And given the situation in the United States today, it seems to me that's pretty unlikely to happen, but that would be the way to go if you wanted to get rid of the Electoral College.
That the, Frank, that the election system itself is corrupt. You got supporters of Trump, of whom, you know, he got just over 74,000, who also back that argument.
Well, you've got corruption is a particularly loaded term. I think you can say there is no evidence of vote stealing or fraud. I think if you want to say that the electoral system is undemocratic, that's another question. And Trump is not saying that. He's simply saying he's alleging fraud, and there is not. The fact of the matter is he lost the vote by 7 million. And in each of the states that he's contesting, Biden's level of victory was greater than Trump's 4 years ago. So what are we talking about here? So again, if you want to say the electoral system is undemocratic because of the Electoral College, that's one thing. But when you use the word corruption, I think that misstates the situation. The vote was not stolen. There is absolutely no evidence to that effect by anybody, including the Trump people, who, when they go to court, rarely mention fraud. They talk about procedural issues, including, incidentally, in this filing for December, the one that was just today.
So, Frank, do you believe that the electoral system, the Electoral College itself, is undemocratic?
Of course it's undemocratic. That's what it was set up to do. You give a system, you put in place a system where, in fact, you can win the presidency of this country, which happened now three times in the last 20 years, with a minority vote. It happened probably with Bush-Gore. It certainly happened with Hillary and Trump the last time. And so, you know, Hillary had more votes than Trump in 2016, you know. And so, sure, and I think lots and lots of people believe it. And if it's an undemocratic system, that may be true. That does not equate to fraud. It equates to an undemocratic system. And there can be many, many changes that can be made. We also see maneuvers with what we call gerrymandering here, which comes from 1812, incidentally, Elbridge Gerry from Massachusetts. But that's neither here nor there. But the restructuring of congressional districts to maximize a vote of one party or another and minimize the other and maneuver it so that, as in Wisconsin, Democrats can get almost 60% of the vote, but only get 40% of the seats in the state legislature. So there's all kinds of aspects of our voting system that could be improved for sure and made more democratic. And there's many, many ways to do it. But Trump is not advocating any of them. He's advocating for the overthrow of the election and the delegitimization of the election and of Biden. That's what he's after here. And, you know, if he, I think that is what's got the Supreme Court and all the other courts upset, really. When it gets down to it, that they're dealing with somebody who says, I do not believe in this, whatever the excuse is. And I don't think that the institutional people in this country, and I include in that, incidentally, finally, some of the Republicans in Congress, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Supreme Court, I don't think that they are ready to cast aside the entire election because this guy, Trump, is demanding it. I don't see that.
Right, yeah, and you've got some really high-ranking Republicans on the Supreme Court that also back your argument, Frank. But
three out of the nine people on the Supreme Court are his appointees, and the fact that those three did not sign any dissent last week over when Texas was thrown out was very significant. And I think that they've been very clear that they're not going to have the Supreme Court overturn the election in this instance. I think they've been very clear about that now several times, and I suspect that will happen with this suit as well. And again, it's a PR thing. It's an issue to sow dissension. Yet I don't think it's a legal effort on his part. And then what does he have to do? He has to pardon Giuliani, his lawyer, because of alleged criminal activity. I mean, that's what we're at here. Let's be serious.
Right. Great stuff. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there, run out of time. Frank M. Speck, Emeritus Professor at the University of Wisconsin, joining us. We also had Ronnie Caravello, our own correspondent in Miami. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your thoughts there. And staying in the U.S., where Senate's Republican leader says the congressional leaders of both parties have agreed on a roughly $900 billion coronavirus relief bill. Mitch McConnell added that there is more help on the way to provide assistance to address several COVID-19 related issues. The package is expected to include aid for a vaccine distribution and logistics, extra jobless benefits, and a new round of stimulus checks. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer also confirmed the agreement, stating that a vote will take place on the bill soon. This comes as the pandemic continues to take a heavy toll on the American people, as well as the economy, which has been battered by rising jobless claims. COVID-19 has so far claimed over 317,000 lives out of more than 17.8 million cases in the U.S., the world's worst-hit country. Meanwhile, a number of countries have banned travel to and from the UK to prevent the spread of a more infectious strain of the coronavirus. The Netherlands, Belgium, Italy, France, Germany, Turkey, and Ireland have suspended or are planning to suspend flights and train arrivals from Britain. A German government official says the entire 27-member European Union could adopt the restrictions. Iran has also announced a two-week halt in flights between Tehran and destinations in Britain. The World Health Organization has called on its European members to step up measures against the new variant circulating in Britain. British health officials say the new coronavirus variant spreads 70% faster than the original and is out of control. The government has imposed a strict Christmas lockdown in London and South East England to rein in the spread of the virus. Britain says significant differences remain with the European Union in negotiations over a post-Brexit trade deal. A senior British government official said talks would continue on Monday to explore every route to find a deal. Previously, the two sides had set Sunday as the deadline for the talks. Negotiations have in particular stalled over the EU's fishing rights in British waters. A bloc's diplomat said if Britain doesn't accept the latest offer, there will be no deal. The two sides must get a deal by December 31st. A no-deal scenario would mean border chaos for both sides and reliance on World Trade Organization rules that could possibly lead to price hikes. Austria braces for its third hard lockdown starting on December 26th and lasting for 3 weeks. The government says it will be rolling out free tests for the public after the lockdown. Hermeleski reports.
The Austrian government announces a third hard lockdown starting immediately after Christmas on the 26th of December. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz had promised that the second lockdown, which ended 2 weeks ago, would save Christmas, but that mission has proven to be nearly impossible. Like the majority of nations around the world, Austrians are not expecting a regular Christmas or New Year's Eve. But things don't look entirely bleak, as vaccinations are set to begin across Europe and Austria on the 27th of December. With every week, says Chancellor Kurz, we get a step closer to ending this pandemic.
Measures will become stricter until the seven-day incident is below 100, and in mid-January there will be free mass tests for everyone who wants to take part.
The goal is to keep weekly cases below 100 per 100,000 people. That number currently stands at just under 200. The lockdown is expected to end on January 18th, but only for those who agree to get tested. For those not willing to take the test, the stay-at-home order and curfew will be in place for another extra week. Health Minister Rudolf Anschober expressed concern over the dramatic increase in mortalities across the country over the last 2 months.
With no further measures, at the end of the month, new cases could range between 1,300 and 3,000 cases a day.
For now, the new restrictions mean everyone entering Austria from abroad has to go into a 10-day quarantine, which can only be cut short after 5 days with a negative PCR or antigen test.
Over the Christmas holidays, more contacts and therefore more cases are expected, and the latest preventive measures announced by the government are meant to bridge the time until the vaccine can be rolled out in the new year. Homolezki, Vienna.
Meanwhile, in Australia, A new cluster of COVID-19 has spread to over 50 locations in Sydney, prompting all other states and territories to close borders with the city. Authorities have urged the city's 5 million residents to get tested or self-isolated if they have visited the declared infected locations. Nearly 70 cases of infections of the new virus cluster have so far been reported, but the number is expected to increase. Dozens of domestic flights due to leave Sydney were also cancelled. Australia has largely avoided high coronavirus numbers compared to other developed nations, but the new cluster has sparked fears of a wider outbreak. The country has recorded just over 28,000 cases and 908 deaths since the pandemic began. And the coronavirus pandemic is devastating Gaza's ailing economy amid the crippling Israeli blockade. Meanwhile, lockdown measures to control the fast spread of COVID-19 have had grave economic implications. Press TV's correspondent Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
The coronavirus pandemic has worsened the dire economic conditions in the blockaded Gaza Strip, leaving a huge impact on the livelihoods of people in the tiny coastal enclave. The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has already caused a sharp decline in the standards of living, as well as alarming levels of unemployment and poverty in the seaside sliver even before the pandemic. Meanwhile, tight lockdown measures to contain COVID-19 have had grave economic implications on all sectors in the Gaza Strip. Experts say the coronavirus pandemic has brought the blockaded enclave's economy to a virtual standstill, driving more Palestinians into poverty.
The economy is a vital lifeline, and the Israeli blockade has crippled this lifeline. The coronavirus restrictions have only worsened the situation. Currently, around 85% of the population live below the poverty line, with an average income of only $2 a day.
Lockdowns are directly affecting thousands of daily wage laborers and their dependents, and resulting in suspension of operations in the vast majority of businesses in the Gaza Strip. The coronavirus pandemic has added to the substantial financial strain already felt by many families living in the Gaza Strip.
The coronavirus pandemic has affected economies all over the world. In Gaza, we're suffering the most amid this pandemic because of the ongoing blockade and the lack of resources.
The economy is in a very bad shape, especially during lockdowns, and shops and restaurants are closed. Many businesses had to lay off workers because they can't pay their wages.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 33,000 coronavirus infections since late August. In an attempt to curb the rapid spread of the deadly virus, local authorities currently impose lockdowns from 6 p.m. until 7 a.m., and a complete curfew on Fridays and Saturdays.
We have imposed lockdowns as part of our preventive measures to slow the spread of the deadly virus. The Ministry of Interior is sparing no effort to minimize the number of coronavirus cases. The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is very high, and we are trying different approaches to contain the virus.
Experts say the pandemic will exacerbate the underlying humanitarian crisis that has gripped Gaza for years.
The COVID-19 pandemic is adding extra strains on Gaza's ailing economy. All economic sectors in the impoverished enclave are already suffering because of the Israeli blockade and multiple wars. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Brings it into our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
A new report highlights 2021's most pressing humanitarian crises and perhaps no surprise to many, victims of U.S. wars and regime change efforts top the list. The International Rescue Committee yearly report on the world's most pressing humanitarian situations has just been published, with the three most disastrous cases, including Yemen, Afghanistan, and Syria, all the product of decades of interventionist U.S. foreign policy. While the damage 2020 has done to the world cannot be undone, the IRC warned that 2021 could be just as important from a humanitarian point of view. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Alan McLeod Ryder. This article is published under the heading 2021's most pressing humanitarian crises are all victims of U.S. war and regime change. Here's the details of this article. The International Rescue Committee, or IRC, yearly report on the world's most pressing humanitarian situations has just been published, with the three most disastrous cases including Yemen, Afghanistan, and Syria, all the product of decades of interventionist U.S. foreign policy. For the third year in a row, Yemen has topped the IRC list, the report estimating that 80% of the country's 29 million citizens are in need of humanitarian assistance. The world is facing unprecedented humanitarian emergencies as well as a political crisis of inaction by world leaders, they warn. 20.5 million people inside Yemen lack access to clean water and sanitation. This is in no small part due to the five-year-long Saudi-led coalition onslaught against the country, which has seen over 200 targeted attacks against medical or sanitation infrastructure equivalent to one air raid every 10 days. As a result, half of all health facilities are not functioning properly, and over half of the country's children are permanently physically stunted due to malnutrition. The Yemeni rial has lost a quarter of its value this year, with food and fuel prices increasing amid shortages. Women and girls are disproportionately affected by the crisis. 1 million pregnant women are also malnourished. Despite the devastation, humanitarian support to the country has actually been decreasing thanks to the work of the Trump administration. Throughout 2020, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been successfully pressuring the United Nations and its donor nations to scale back aid to Yemen in an attempt to starve the Ansarullah movement into submission, a consequence of over 5 years of war and severe underfunding that has pushed the country to new lows in 2020, the report notes, although it does not point any finger at the United States. Yemen faces a triple threat from conflict, hunger, and a collapsing international response, said Abir Fawzi, the IRC's deputy nutrition coordinator. The other countries on the IRC's top 10 most concerning humanitarian situations included Afghanistan, Syria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Burkina Faso, South Sudan, Nigeria, and Mozambique. What is striking about the three most pressing cases is the role of the United States in worsening the problem. The The U.S. invaded and occupied Afghanistan 19 years ago and continues to refuse to leave, flooding the country with arms and propping up its chosen political factions. Syria, meanwhile, is the site of a bitter international conflict, confusingly labeled a civil war, where the great powers, including the U.S., vie for control of the West Asian nation, fueling continual violence that has led to a crisis of 5.8 million refugees and a further 6.7 million internally displaced people, according to the IRC report. While once a reasonably prosperous nation, today 90% of the population lives below the poverty line. Meanwhile, Venezuela has faced years of crippling American sanctions that one United Nations rapporteur compared to the medieval siege, estimating they had cost the lives of over 100,000 Venezuelans. However, the obvious role that the U.S. regime has played in destabilizing or destroying so many nations on the list is not remarked upon. Indeed, the words United States are not mentioned anywhere in the 59-page report. One potential reason could be that the IRC, headquartered in New York City, is substantially funded by the U.S. regime through its Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and the Department of Health and Human Services. While the U.S. regime has contributed over $2.5 billion in aid to Yemen, that number pales in comparison with weapons sales to the Saudi Arabia regime, the chief driver of the violence in Yemen. American-made bombs continue to be dropped by American-made jets, maintained by American operatives, and flown by American-trained pilots. And even as he leaves office, President Trump is making a point of showering Saudis with gifts. While the damage 2020 has done to the world cannot be undone, the IRC warned that 2021 could be just as important from a humanitarian point of view. 2020 will go down as one of the most turbulent years in history, but the next year will be remembered for how we either helped or turned away from those suffering the most, they stated.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. And in this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And today we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much for being here. So in our previous two programs, we have been talking about a question that we had on the emphasis on self-esteem and how we can foster this in our children, because we want them to grow up as confident, you know, human beings with self-esteem, which is also linked with faith as well.
Exactly.
So you've been telling us how we can administer this self-esteem in a child when, you know, they're young. We are hoping that you can continue on that.
Yeah, last time I spoke about talking to the child.
Okay.
Constantly talking to the child, listening to the child's needs, what he has to say, being interested in what he has to say. And then another factor to increase the self-esteem is when, for example, we're pointing the mistakes of a child and we want to teach them.
Yeah.
So, for example, sometimes it so happens that we want to scold the child. Of course, we should know that scolding a child, not in a loud voice, but in a tone that he understands, that this is a stern tone,
yeah,
that, you know, he needs to now reprimand for his mistakes or amend for his mistakes. So he has done something very silly for his age and time and place. So we shouldn't destroy his feeling of self-worth and okay. call him a bad boy in general or a bad girl in general. We should reprove of the action rather than the
saying
person.
Saying that he is bad, we should say that action wasn't
good. Yes, that action wasn't good. Not that you are good for nothing. This attitude destroys the child's self-worth. He feels really he's good at nothing. Whatever you inculcate in a very young age, he will think he is like that. And that's why children sometimes get complexes.
Yeah.
That I'm not good enough. I can never be like this. Even when, for example, we as human beings think that we could never reach very lofty stations, we sometimes have this strain of lack of self-esteem.
Yeah.
We can. It's open. In fact, Allah has encouraged us so much that however much you've asked for forgiveness, you still can. I will wipe all the sins and, you know, you'll come again to start afresh.
Yeah, that don't give up.
Don't give up, yes. In fact, people become better even after asking forgiveness.
They become better
than before even when they have not sinned.
Yeah, exactly.
Because Allah loves those who He forgives and asks for forgiveness.
So in this example that you gave, what about, we can also include, that if you scold the child near people.
Yeah, exactly. That's even counted as spoiling the self-esteem very badly.
Mm-hmm.
If you scold him near the people, he will feel everybody is looking at him.
And
then people will also look at him in that way.
Yeah.
They would respect him because they feel that his mother himself or his parent himself is not respecting the child. So, you know, we can easily not respect him. It's very important. And you can see it at home also between siblings. If the father is always reproaching a boy near his siblings, the other siblings will also reproach them.
Yeah.
My father said so. So, like, it's a normal thing for them. So it's very important that, you know, child should learn to believe in himself by feeling that sense of respect from the parents, that when they want to reproach him, they should reproach for the deed and give him a chance.
Yeah.
Allah also gives chances. So it doesn't mean that you can, you know, just lay it off, that's it now. You are no worth.
Yeah, you're useless.
Yeah, you're useless or something like that.
Whereas, unfortunately, when this happens, it really destroys the child.
It really destroys because, you know, a child learns very fast from a young age. So whatever is taught to him at a young age, it'll carry with him for the rest of his life.
Very true. We're going to take a short break and inshallah we'll continue with this after the break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear audience, to the IRIB English Radio broadcasting from Iran. And this is Islamic Upbringing. So we have been talking about self-esteem.
Another thing is that parents should also remember when they do wrong, there's some good in them also,
Mm.
So it doesn't mean that they forget the goodness in them. to spoil that sense of, worth in them. Yeah. They should remind, for example, the children that, I thought that you have this character in you which is so good. What happened to you at this time, you know? Like, give him a kind of advice in the right, appropriate way and manner and tone of voice so that he cannot feel dejected. So that will raise his self-esteem.
So by telling him, for instance, you know, this action wasn't appropriate.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have all these other good qualities. So exactly. Maybe, you know, like trying to say, look, you're now, doesn't mean now you only know how to do these actions. I know your other good actions.
Exactly. Also. Things like that, that parents themselves know how to deal with. Just the fact that they should not forget that their child is not like worthless.
Mm.
That if he made certain mistakes, they should make him feel like this. So self-esteem really grows when the child is felt that, yeah, it's the action. I'm not a bad person.
Yeah.
So the complex will not also stay in him. And mostly this inferiority complex comes about because of destroying the self-esteem. That, you know, you feel, can you do it? No, you can't. I'm like this. I was told like this from a young age. I could never do that.
So comparing also.
Yeah, comparing also. Comparing also brings this sense of complex in a child. So another thing that would raise the self-esteem is to listen to his ideas, a child's ideas and opinions. And that's why sometimes you have to even ask the child what to do. For example, discuss the child about his opinion on certain things. For example, you want to shift to a house, another house. You have to ask them, what do you think about this idea?
Yeah.
Would you like to shift in this area? Maybe he would say that, no, I wouldn't, because I'd lose all my friends. And maybe you could explain to him, you know, and train him to adjust to new kinds of situations by saying that you'll get new friends.
Yeah.
This, for example, this and this school.
And also he'll feel part of it, you know, he'll feel like
part of it, and it's not a kind of a shock for him to face that.
Yeah.
So listen to his ideas and opinions. Sometimes, you know, we don't encourage a child to talk. We ridicule him. Like, for example, when we go to a gathering and he wants to say something, we feel that he's going to utter something very embarrassing. So we shut him up, you know, with our actions. We don't know. The child needs to speak. And everybody around would understand that
he's a child.
So let him speak what he wants to. Yeah. Of course, then you can teach him if he was wrong. But you listen to him with respect. If a child has self-esteem, he will never say something wrong. Yeah. Or something embarrassing in front of everyone. And he'll probably just give his opinion.
And also with mistakes a child grows. We're going to take a short break, and inshallah we'll continue with this after the break.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, love children, be kind to them, and whenever you promise something to them, fulfill it.
Welcome back, dear audience, to the IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. So we have been talking about self-esteem, and right now you have told us that the mistakes we do that break the child's self-esteem, and some of the things you mentioned was, for example, pointing out mistakes in not the appropriate way, and, you know, or maybe near people, and then forgetting the good part of him, or maybe telling the child that he is wrong, while instead of saying that the action was wrong. And basically also trying to listen to their ideas, just counting them as important.
Yeah. And also, for example, dismissing a child's opinions as being unworthy so that it can suppress any kinds of ideas and creativity or thoughtfulness in the child in future. Another thing is that always speak positively about him to others. You know, even if he has some mistake, you know, never speak that today. You know what this so-and-so my child did?
Yeah.
It would really, really, you know, kind of shatter him.
Very true.
When the child hears himself being talked about positively, he feels that it is an appreciation. It needs not to be like long praises or undeserved praise.
Yeah.
Something that he did.
For example, every child has some goodness, so it's not like you're...
For example, if your child has probably learned some few words himself, learned reading, then you can tell somebody near that child that, mashallah, she has learned reading.
Mm.
Yeah, so it encourages the child that I'm appreciated for this reading. Although my mother knows everything of it.
Yeah.
But I am appreciated for that small things that I've learned.
I'm trying.
Yeah. So it's good to mention it to a relative or friend without, of course, undeserved praise or long, long praises. And they should be genuine, of course. So parents who criticize and complain about the child to others, in front of the child especially, often ruin this feeling of self-worth in the child. They feel very rejected that now so-and-so knows my mistakes. And often you will see children are very smart. They will come and tell their parents, why did you tell this?
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Why would you have told this thing about myself to them? And they would feel it affects them in the long run.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
I feel like till even when they grow up, they feel that feeling that, you know, if somebody talks about me, like it ruins a lot.
And the sad thing is sometimes parents and relatives act as if that the child cannot hear.
Yeah.
And the child is very smart. They discuss him in his presence, comparing him to others, mentioning the bad qualities he has. And this has a long-term negative effect on the child.
Unfortunately.
It's completely like the self-worth, which Allah wants that because, and he's amanat of Allah. Parents forget that these are not theirs. They are amanats of Allah. They have to return this amanat of Allah. And Allah himself has said, وَلَكَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمَ. I have respected the Bani Adam. So, of course, we have who are we? So we are amanatdar.
Yeah.
The parents are amanatdar to return back this human being the way Allah wants it to return, right?
Trying to like make the child the most perfect so that he can, you know, reach his goals and try and, you know, reach perfection when he grows
up.
Yes,
exactly. Then another thing we need to inculcate in a child is to think about himself in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
Think of himself to achieve success. This is very important. Encourage him to set goals. For example, have high expectations of himself. Encourage him. For example, if there's something to study, show him that he can study ahead and be prepared for the next lesson before he gets that lesson.
Yeah.
You know, or tell him that, for example, if you have an exam, encourage him how to, you know, set his goals so that he can really do well in the exam. For example, if it's 2 months away, you can teach him to set a portion of time for himself to study so that when the exam comes near, he's already prepared and he's not awake the whole night to study at the last moment.
Like make him munazzam, like
organized. Set up goals for him.
Yeah.
To think that he can achieve a great deal.
That's very nice, yes. Thank you very much. I'm sure we all learned a lot. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on this program. And if you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irrb.ir, and visit us at our website, partstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life. A way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Just before the coronavirus struck, 35 million Americans, 11 million of them children, experienced food insecurity, the lowest figure in two decades. This year, those numbers are projected to reach 54 million and 18 million, respectively. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Rain Menon Ryder. This article is published under the heading, 54 million Americans are projected to be food insecure by end of year. Here's the details of this article. As autumn fades and winter looms, the dire predictions public health experts made about COVID-19 have unfortunately proven all too accurate. On October 27th, 74,379 people were infected in the United States. Less than a month and a half later, on December 9th, that number had soared to 218,677, while the 2020 total has just surpassed 15 million, a number no other country, not even India, which has a population three times that of the US, has surpassed. And now it seems the third wave of the virus has arrived. As recently as late October, the embattled Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's leading infectious disease expert, warned that we are in for a whole lot of hurt, and that infections could reach 100,000 a day. As it happens, he was widely optimistic. A little more than a month later, there were more than twice that many. Is it possible, however, that the current surge is due in part to increased testing, as Donald Trump and others have regularly claimed? Here's the problem. Even if that theory were true, it can't account for the spiraling death toll, which is now more than 300,000 and could hit 450,000 by February, according to Robert Redfield, the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Nor can it explain the daily COVID-19 hospitalizations. The first round of which peaked at 59,712 on July 23rd, dropped pretty steadily to a low of 20,606 on September 20th, and then started to soar, reaching 106,671 on December 9th. What U.S. officials don't reveal is the searing effects it's had on the lives of millions of Americans, even those who have managed to evade the virus or haven't seen friends or family fall ill or die from COVID-19. Surprisingly, American people who have been laid off or had their work hours reduced have fallen behind on their mortgage and rent payments. Although various federal and state moratoriums on such payments, as well as on evictions and foreclosures, were enacted, such protections will eventually end. And the moratoriums don't negate renters' or homeowners' obligations to settle accounts with their bankers and landlords somewhere down the line. which for many Americans may in the end prove an impossibility. Apart from the illness and death it causes, perhaps the most important consequence of COVID-19 has been the way it's increased what's called food insecurity across the United States of America. That ungainly term doesn't refer to the chronic food scarcity and undernourishment, which afflicts more than 800 million people in poor countries, but rather to the disruption of people's typical food consumption patterns. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, distinguishes between what it calls low food security, reduced quality, variability or desirability of diet, and the very low version of the same, multiple indications of disrupted eating patterns and reduced food intake. Surveys by the USDA and the Census Bureau show that both variants have risen steeply during the pandemic. Just before the coronavirus. Income supplements provided by $2.2 trillion CARES Act that Congress passed in March, created by COVID-19, increases in the government's supplementary nutritional program, that is SNAP, and the pandemic electronic benefit, that is PEBT, which helps 18.4% of American adults reported that at least some members of their family did not have enough to eat. By July 2020, that figure had hit 11%. According to a study by Northwestern University's Food Research and Action Center, and will only increase as the pandemic worsens. Income supplements provided by $2.2 trillion CARES Act that Congress passed in March in response to the economic problems created by COVID-19 increases in the government's supplementary nutritional program, that is SNAP, and the pandemic electronic benefit, that is PEBT, which helps parents whose children no longer get free or subsidized school lunches have made a difference. But not enough to make up for lost or reduced income, lost homes, and other disasters of this moment. And sadly, any follow-up to the CARES Act, assuming Congress reaches some kind of agreement on its terms before the current legislation expires at the end of December, will almost certainly be far less generous than the original law. The SNAP increases already excluded the poorest 7 million households in the U.S., that were then receiving the maximum amount, and the new increases now under discussion in Congress would add less than $1 to a four-person family's maximum daily benefit. PEBT expired in most states at the end of September, in some as early as July. Millions of people have lost their jobs in the U.S. Some have seen their earnings diminished because of furloughs, wage cuts, freezes, or reduced working hours. Others have looked for jobs in vain and finally given up, but aren't included in official unemployment statistics. Millions of adults have children who no longer receive those free or subsidized lunches because of the switch, in whole or part, to online teaching. Worse yet, as pandemic-induced firings, layoffs, and wage cuts have reduced incomes and so consumer purchasing power, food prices, especially for meat, fish, and eggs, have only risen. Such costs have increased for other reasons as well. The pandemic has disrupted supply networks, national and international. Leery consumers anticipating shortages or seeking to reduce trips to grocery stores to avoid being infected by COVID-19 have also resorted to panic buying and stockpiling of food and other necessities. Not surprisingly, the bigger the hit people took from the COVID-19 recession, the more likely they were to experience food insecurity, which is why aggregate statistics on the phenomenon and other societal problems attributable to the pandemic can be misleading. The variations are rooted in ethnicity and location as well as income level, and the three tend to be closely linked. A USDA report classified 19% of black households and 16% of Hispanic households as food insecure in 2019, compared to 8% of their white counterparts. By this summer, food insecurity had increased significantly across the board, afflicting 36% of black, 32% of Hispanic, and 18% of white households. While the pandemic has certainly made matters worse, African Americans had the highest rate among those three groups even before it started. This was especially true of counties. The U.S. has more than 3,000 of them, in which they were in the majority. In 2016, those particular counties accounted for a mere 3% of the national total, but 96% of them had high food insecurity, as the Department of Agriculture defines it, as well as a poverty rate more than twice the national average, 12.7% that year. Native Americans have had the worst of it, however, since many of their families lack access to running water and plumbing, 58 per 1,000 households compared to 3 per 1,000 for whites. Nearly 75% of Native Americans must travel more than a mile to reach a supermarket, compared to 40% of the population as a whole. And the disruption of supply chains has only diminished their food security further relative to the other ethnic communities. Even prior to the pandemic, counties in which they or Native Alaskans constituted a majority were among those with the highest levels of food insecurity. Not coincidentally, in 2016, the poverty rate in nearly 70% of Native American majority counties averaged a whopping 37%. In other words, while every group has suffered in this pandemic year, race matters a lot when it comes to the degree of suffering. In coronavirus-stricken America, only 1% of adults with an annual income exceeding $100,000 surveyed by the Census Bureau this summer responded that, during the preceding week, their households sometimes or often did not have enough to eat. Compare that to 16% of those making $25,000.